From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. On this Memorial Day, we're rebroadcasting some of our favorite interviews. We'll hear from Alex Archowski of the Greater Philadelphia Veterans Network about the narrative many vets have to contend with upon returning home, that re-entering civilian life is a struggle, how this perception can dampen efforts to find employment. Also, domestic violence and sexual assault can be a serious problem among teens and young adults. Valencia Peterson, known as Coach V, is an educator helping to break the cycle. We'll also hear from high school football player Jacquez Maben. And a treasured historical landmark in Philly's Strawberry Mansion neighborhood is deteriorating, the home of jazz superstar John Coltrane. Faye Anderson of All That Philly Jazz will tell us about a campaign to restore the Coltrane House. That's all ahead on Radio Times, after the news on WHYY. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Radio Times Regional Roundup, the Memorial Day edition. Safe to say, the transition from military to civilian life can be a challenge on a number of levels, including the job hunt. Nearly 19 million men and women called themselves veterans as of 2018, according to the Labor Department. And while the unemployment rate for vets was actually a little lower than that of the average across the nation, misperceptions remain in the business world about who veterans are when they come home and what they bring to the table. Alex Archowski is a Navy veteran and founder of the Greater Philadelphia Veterans Network. He shares his experiences in looking for work with fellow veterans and helps them to develop search plans, to network, and more. Alex Archowski, when you first came home, what did you find when you started looking for work?
Well, I think the new identity is the number one challenge. So if you think about what the perception is, you know, the veterans are needing help. So what happens, it sounds a little bit like case management, but it's really not. It's just learning how to identify your new self. Some take a day, some take a week, some take a month. It's like riding a bike. And it really depends on people's background. Doesn't matter if they're officer enlisted. It really depends. And what we do, what I saw is the biggest gap, and I can talk about a little bit more in the transition, is we help people really focus on who they want to become. Small company, big company, leading individuals, all contributors, different types of jobs, rather than saying, do you want to work with X logo?
So it's really about carving out a new identity.
Correct.
When you're back. Let's talk a little bit about the differences between the traditional civilian workplace and a military base.
I mean, there's a lot of companies that have great leaderships in there. So I think the biggest thing is if companies look at it saying, well, look at, you know, the Marines just celebrated their 244th anniversary. So that company's 244 years old. So it goes in and out with personnel and the mission continues. That's amazing. Think about companies. Just imagine if your personnel were changing every year and a half or two and you had new people to come in and achieve success. That right there, you can write case studies, articles on or anything like that. So with the military, there's so many dynamics of things that happen. I always tell people, you know, one of the things you learn in the military, sometimes you're professionally disappointed. So what that means is every time you get ready and focus for something, it's canceled. So I'll give you an example. So when we were in the Far East and we had a long deployment and the captain said, okay, we're going to go to Hong Kong. So we're like, oh, great, you know, a little break. So right when we got near Hong Kong, a typhoon, which is hurricane here, slammed the area and the captain goes, sorry, we got to go back to sea. So what happens is you've learned how to be disappointed at a young age. So really the stamina of our veterans is so high that we can't be disappointed anymore. You know, at 18, 19, 20 years old, you're working for a mission that things you never thought you could do at a young age.
Yeah.
But when you're a veteran and you went through and you achieve a lot of success, sometimes it challenges you of your identity of who are you successful. So we make sure that they don't take a step back of their confidence, if that makes sense.
You also work in training employers.
Correct.
So what does that training involve?
So we have a tagline called Our Tools, Your Mission. So we've never called a company and never called a veteran to do what we ask them to do. We really need to hear where the mission is of organizations and veterans. We just give them the tools for their success. So if companies come out and saying, we want to hire veterans, we really want to know behind the scene, what does success look like for you other than hiring a veteran? So we have learn, engage, hire, retain, and promote. It's really about the success of, are you doing it? And we tell them, any answer is a good answer. So we're not here to judge you. Are you doing it because everybody else is doing it? Are you doing it for what purposes? Because then we said that is the success of the veteran in your company. And we have to understand that. So we have a filtering process because we want to work with organizations that really have it. If they don't have a business plan for it, we help create it for them because that's what they want about how to locally hire vets, engage with them. Student veterans on campuses, hundreds and hundreds in these local universities. So there's a model called high tech and high touch. So we tell them to say, if you're willing to do high touch, since we're greater Philadelphia, you'll have much more success.
Let's talk about large businesses, corporations, et cetera, versus small businesses. According to a recent survey by the Small Business Index, while business owners agree that it's important to hire veterans, fewer than two-thirds of businesses owned by vets and fewer than half of non-veteran-owned businesses have done so. Do you find that number surprising?
It's not. There's a formula. So if you think about it, there are some very familiar logos out there, and they're great, great companies that hire vets. So everybody thinks those are the companies to work for. As veterans, you see your peers and you go to your peers. So we form relationship with chambers and rotaries where all the small companies lie, right? And what we found out is they don't have a traditional recruiting department. So then we say, why don't we mix it up and bring veterans to chambers, to rotaries, to help them get together, mingling and networking, to really draw them together to focus on that activity. It's hard for small businesses, no matter what, to hire.
Because of the bottom line. Well, I'm thinking about recruiting, too, and resource outreach. That's something else that they have to figure into the bottom line, and that might be difficult for some of them.
So it is. So we don't want to tell them this is how you do it. We try to make them realize it's easier than they think. And the way that it works is if there's a few veterans inside companies, those are the recruiters. Those are absolutely the recruiters. They will go out and do the activities. They will go out to our programs and events and carry the company flag. The ones that have been doing that are the most successful companies. So what happens is it's a different model today. And it's the same model if a big company has campus recruiting at Penn State and they send Penn State alumni. And I said, you're sending Penn State alumni to Penn State. Send veterans to veterans. It's the same model. So recruiting is shifting a little bit to realize they can't separate veterans in their companies, saying, well, that's a project manager. They're not in recruiting. I said, those are your biggest assets for recruiting.
Does it matter large or small business?
It doesn't. I think that it depends on the role they want to fill. And believe it or not, what we've seen is we've seen small to medium-sized companies value the veteran more on skill sets than some larger ones. So if you don't mind, I'll give you some of the challenges we still lie for veterans. It's not the veteran, it's the way the work is approached. Hourly rates. So we don't understand still how people think that way about hourly. So if any of the companies are listening to now, if you think of hourly, that means that's the value we bring. We're at the bottom. And when we hear sometimes, listen, we've been trying to hire, but we're struggling. We thought we'd try to reach out to veterans. We still seem like the bottom. So what happens is the business case hasn't been met there. That's just okay. But they can't look at it because we can't help them if they're thinking that way.
How would you change the narrative? What would it sound like?
For them, it's just education. We have programs, how to hire veterans, roundtable, different things, how to hire student vets, how to hire senior leaders. We're going to have a big program in 2020 of how to hire senior military leaders, which is still a challenge for most companies. So they think of, if you think of a veteran, you think of a 21, 22-year-old right out of the military, 25. Some people are doing 15, 20 years, and they're moving their families back.
Yeah. And so, that's a drop back, too, because they've reached a certain position within the military, and then you come back to a different world, and perhaps you're not finding a job that's equal to that in terms of challenge, stature, salary.
Correct. So some of them, they bring in a little bit of angst because they have a family transition, new social structure, all their friends and allies and everything they've known, paperwork, uniform, and everything's gone. So what happens is it's an explanation of not in a bad way, but you're institutionalized. So institutionalized means this: when you're given orders, wake up, go to PT, eat chow, go to firing range, go learn, go. You do it well. So when you get out, we have to teach people how to be the CEO of their own success. We don't tell them what to do, which is we're teaching a lot of our ambassadors and volunteers and mentors. Do not tell them what to do. That's what they want to hear. You got to help them create their own success.
Let's take a look at underemployment. According to LinkedIn, it's an issue among several cities with large veteran populations. They're working, but they're not utilizing their skill sets fully. Are you hearing this from the veterans you are working with?
I think that we have programs on veteran leadership. So we have we're there for their whole life cycle. One, they get out of the military, how they become leaders, and then they become business owners. So our mission is economic success and making Greater Philadelphia one of the best destinations for vets, with our Shark Tank at the end, veteran Shark Tank at the end. But the whole premise is veterans need to realize that it's a game to get promoted. It's a political game sometimes. And sometimes they have to really raise their hand harder and be shut down harder. And it's just because somebody shut down their idea does not mean that they're not valued. It's just they have to understand the different culture of civilian companies. And like anybody else, if it's not a good fit, some people may transfer after 2 years, which is normal. But I think they realize that it's not about getting the work done. It's about how do you go above and beyond to get promoted. It's a competition internally as well. So those are the new orders they need to realize. Some have it in their DNA and some learn it. Some learn it. Don't wait for the orders to come to you. It's still one of those, okay, I got a job.
Yeah.
Now I can sit back. And I said, no, there's tons of skills behind that.
For veterans who really need some help in carving out that new identity and finding the resilience and being okay with perhaps starting in a different place and working their way back up in a new career, is there enough outreach, enough available in terms of resources from the VA?
Yes. I look at it like this. A lot of people raise their hand, even in the civilian world, saying, hey, I want a mentor. Hey, I want, but do they really want one? The question is, do they want to be better or they just want to say, I got a mentor? Doing the activities is hard. And to be better, you can't go to an organization saying, hey, I want to be, are you willing to do the activities? Are you willing to be better? And especially in job search. Job search is some of the hardest activities. So if you don't mind, we'll talk about networking.
Yeah, sure.
So networking is very unique. Sometimes I laugh, and we all laugh, with all our volunteers and board members and advisory and committees, is, the military makes us sometimes the worst job candidates. We're very humble. We don't talk much, and then we did our job, and then personal branding we're working on a little bit more.
That all has to change.
And then think about it. We're the most risk adverse we thought we were. Well, why should I climb that mountain? What's on the other side? So when we tell people, hey, go network at this event, immediately, if you're very military, you're like, well, what's going to happen from there? Am I going to get a job? Am I going to do that? So we really have to focus on how are you going to do the activities? Don't ask for help unless you're willing to do the activities.
Why did you get into mentoring?
My profession is I'm a president of a sales training company, so it's all about human performance and human behavior. And unfortunately, I always say I was unfortunately blessed in the military to where I am today. So as a search and rescue swimmer, they basically almost tattooed inside my body about saving a life, not on the outside, in the inside. And, it's got its pros and cons. Biggest assets, biggest your liability. You can't save them all. So it's true, can't save all.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Veterans can't save everybody, but how do you help? It's a little bit like Six Sigma. It's a little very process-oriented. So just because I was a rescue swimmer doesn't mean I was going to swim in the Schuylkill or the Delaware River, right? So everybody's like, how do you translate? It's not translating. It's learning. So we do programs like Take a Vet to Work. I saw was like Take Your Daughter to Work Day. It says they need to be civilianized and really teaching them how to be a good mentee and learn.
That was our November 2019 interview with Alex Archowski, founder of the Greater Philadelphia Veterans Network. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk with Faye Anderson, director of All That Philly Jazz, about the John Coltrane House in Philadelphia and the effort to save it from disrepair. Stay with us.
Thank you.
to the Radio Times Regional Roundup Memorial Day edition. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There's something indefinable yet special about the worn, stately row home at 1511 North 33rd Street in Philadelphia's Strawberry Mansion neighborhood. A touch, perhaps, of the magic of a bygone era, Philly's golden age of jazz. The blue historic marker posted outside the house tells passersby this was once the home of John Coltrane, a celebrated jazz saxophonist and composer, a place where he experienced important formative moments as a young adult developing his craft. Unfortunately, the Coltrane House is falling into disrepair. It's on the Philadelphia Register of Historic Places and has been designated a National Historic Landmark. But without funding and restoration, the significant piece of Philadelphia cultural history will continue to fade away. Faye Anderson is director of All That Philly Jazz, a public history project which is documenting Philly's golden age of jazz. She is leading a campaign to restore the Coltrane House, and she joins us now for Radio Times to talk about the story. First, for those who are not familiar with the jazz world and John Coltrane, he was a true influencer of the genre. Tell us a little bit more.
Oh, absolutely. John Coltrane really stands alone. Every musician, no matter the genre, whether it's rap, soul, they will reference John Coltrane. In fact, a song that I have listened to for decades, it wasn't until a week ago that I realized that he gave John Coltrane a shout-out. It was James Brown's Superbad. Hmm. He tells his saxophonist, throw me some train, brother.
What was John Coltrane to Philadelphia, and what was Philadelphia to John Coltrane?
Well, John Coltrane was born in North Carolina. He came here as a young adult, and it was really, he became part of an ecosystem that nurtured young jazz musicians. It's not a stretch to say there was jazz everywhere. So he had an opportunity to learn here, and you cannot separate Philadelphia's golden age of jazz from John Coltrane. When you mention the house in Strawberry Mansion, the row house, when he first moved here, he joined his mother, who was already here, and they lived in an apartment on 12th Street in Yorktown. And he bought the house in Strawberry Mansion, row house, in 1952. He bought it with the GI Bill. He had served in the Navy. So he moved there with his mother and his beloved cousin Mary.
Let's talk about the house itself. In pictures, despite the wear and tear, it seems to have really great bones.
Let's hope. We don't know that. To put it in context, Philadelphia has thousands of properties and historic resources listed on the local Register of Historic Places, but there are only 67 that are designated National Historic Landmarks. And that's a designation made by the U.S. Secretary of the Interior and is given to places of national significance. And of the 67 in Philadelphia, the 67 includes the Academy of Music, the very place where John Coltrane heard Charlie Parker for the first time. And he later said it changed his life. So you have this man who heard Charlie Parker, this National Historic Landmark, and now his very home is a National Historic Landmark.
This house was witness to Coltrane's formative years.
Formative years.
Jazz, and he went through a lot of formation as an adult.
His formative years, and as he wrote in the liner notes to A Love Supreme, the album of Love Supreme, he experienced a spiritual awakening there.
How so, Faye?
It is where he, well, you would have to ask him what the exact spiritual awakening was. But it was in that house, in the second floor bedroom, back bedroom, where he withdrew. He kicked his heroin addiction cold turkey. So but for what happened in that house, we would not be talking about John Coltrane. He might have gone the way of his idol, Charlie Parker, who died from an overdose. So you cannot separate what happened in the house, the spiritual awakening, kicking his drug habit, cold turkey. And it's also where he composed the album Giant Steps.
Tell us about the deterioration of the home.
I wish I can tell you more. That as a National Historic Landmark, the National Park Service has responsibility to monitor the condition of the house. So as long ago as 2003, the National Park Service noted that there were structural concerns. But again, all it can do is make a recommendation. It does not have the resources or the authority to make the repairs. So this was 2003. Nothing has been done. 17 years later, the house was built in 1909, so it's over 100 years old. So time is not on its side. Mm-hmm. And without access to the property, we don't know the structural integrity.
It is vacant.
It is vacant. It is vacant, and it has been vacant for some time.
It has landed on something called Preservation Pennsylvania's 2020 roster of at-risk sites. What does it mean to a property, Faye, when something lands on this roster?
Well, it means, first of all, it's endangered. There is concern. The list is compiled by Preservation Pennsylvania, which is a nonprofit whose mission is to protect, advocate on behalf of historic and architecturally significant properties. So the listing is an annual listing, and it's intended to bring attention to the condition of historic resources that are in danger. So we nominated, we meaning the Preservation Alliance for Greater Philadelphia, Jazz Bridge, and Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, we submitted the Coltrane House for listing on 2020 Pennsylvania at Risk, and the nomination was successful. And what is hoped with the nomination is why I'm here, is to bring attention to the condition of the Coltrane House, and hopefully action will be taken. When you said that I'm leading a campaign to restore the Coltrane House, that's getting a couple of steps ahead, because okay, without access to the house, there is no campaign. In fact, I've heard from any number of people who have asked about donations. I said, no, cannot solicit donations because it would be a scam. We do not have access to the house. And so the house was sold. Again, Cousin Mary moved there with her cousin, John Coltrane, in 1952. He lived there from 1952 to 1958. And on his frequent trips back to Philadelphia, he stayed there. But in 2004, Cousin Mary sold the house to Norman Ganson, who was a jazz lover who had wonderful plans for the John Coltrane House. But he died 3 years later. And so we don't even know who the owner is, because the owner of record is a man who died in 2007. Hmm. And so we know the family that has access to the property, but unfortunately, for whatever reason, they're not cooperating, and they have not been cooperating for some time.
So, Faye Anderson, if somebody were listening to this program and were interested in helping to whatever it takes to gain access to get a funding stream going, do they check in with Preservation Pennsylvania first? I mean, what is the first step does it take toward trying to move this process forward?
Oh, the first step is to call Mayor Jim Kenney. May I give the number?
Oh, why not?
Call Mayor Jim Kenney at 215-686-2181. Because to the untrained eye, you can see the violations. You can see the holes in the exterior. That the Department of Licenses and Inspections, LNI, has the authority to go in. So Mayor Kenney, yesterday, as even. He can order, tell LNI to go in and inspect the property. That one of his spokespersons said, well, the city has limited resources. They're already on the payroll. It is not going to cost anything extra for a city employee to go and do their job. But when you think about the city, how much money the city has spent maintaining the Frank Rizzo statue, that a statue that the mayor says he doesn't want, residents said they don't want, but still city employees are maintaining that monument to hate, that if someone has recently threw some oodles of noodles on the statue, city employees were Johnny on the spot. So what we want is for Mayor Kenney to tell LNI to inspect the property.
You are angry.
Well, yes, I am, because it's ridiculous that we mentioned Frank Rizzo. Frank Rizzo actually has a reputation among jazz musicians for harassing jazz musicians. So the idea that Frank Rizzo would be protected, but John Coltrane House, a house that people from around the world come to visit, they look at that house and they think, they see the condition of it, that no one cares. The truth is people do care. The Preservation Alliance gets more calls about the John Coltrane House than any other historic property.
Faye Anderson, you say that preserving Coltrane's home would send a message to underserved communities?
Well, absolutely. What does it say if, again, it's a National Historic Landmark? That means it has national significance, that if we cannot protect the John Coltrane House, the message it sends is one, that Philadelphia is not about diversity. Philadelphia is about Ben Franklin. Philadelphia is about the founding fathers. So come to Philadelphia and see this narrow narrative of what Philadelphia is. I talk a lot about John Coltrane being a metaphor for diversity, inclusion, because John Coltrane's Philadelphia was about inclusion.
Tell us more about that.
Well, the jazz clubs, you had one, the Checker Cafe. In fact, PHA wanted to demolish that building. I stopped there. But you had female impersonators at the Checker Cafe, that one of the reasons jazz clubs were harassed is because of the jazz culture. It was the first time that blacks and whites were socializing on an equal basis.
Together
in jazz clubs, like the Downbeat, which the Philadelphia police harassed to the point where it put them out of business, that your listeners may be looking forward to tomorrow when the documentary on Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, airs on PBS, that a night when the Miles Davis Quintet was playing at one of those clubs, the Blue Note, they call them black and tan clubs, the Blue Note, which was at 15th and Ridge, the very night that the Miles Davis Quintet was performing there, and John Coltrane was a member of the Miles Davis Quintet. The police raided the Blue Note. And then there was a headline a few days later in the Philadelphia Inquirer when the owner said, no, we're not going away of the Downbeat. You will not put us out of business. So to talk about John Coltrane, to talk about Philadelphia's golden age of jazz, which was roughly the 1930s to the 1960s, okay, you're really talking about a culture of inclusion and diversity.
There is, well, you lead a walking tour of Green Book sites.
Oh, yeah.
The Green Book, of course, helped African Americans navigate racially segregated America. And Faye, I guess a number of these sites in Philly in particular are in North Philly. What would the John Coltrane House add to the tour? Tell us a little bit about the tour and how you envision perhaps having the Coltrane House on there.
That the largest cluster of remaining Green Book sites are in South Philly,
okay,
that Center City and South Street area. that the John Coltrane House in North Philly, that would be the second largest cluster. So what I would envision for the John Coltrane House, that at some point we are going to get past this current impasse with the condition of the house, because it's indefensible, it's not sustainable, that the mayor, I was involved with the effort to save the Robert Purvis House, which was home of an abolitionist, which again, an owner not cooperating, and Elle and I finally did go in, but half of the structure had to be demolished. We don't want to wake up one day and half of the Coltrane House demolished. So there is a precedent for Elle and I going in. And so the John Coltrane House could anchor cultural heritage tourism in North Philadelphia. And there are a number of Green Book sites, not in business, but the buildings themselves still in existence, many of which are located on Ridge Avenue in Shawswood.
All right. So it begins with the administration getting into the house, doing an inspection, and then hopefully being on the at-risk site. Perhaps we can get a funding stream going in order to do renovations, restorations, to live up to that blue historic marker that's standing outside the property.
Well, not to live up to, the marker, but live up to the man.
That was a poor choice of words.
to live up to the man. Yeah. The man who left us a love supreme, a man who was all about love, to show him the love that he showed us.
All right, we're going to go out on John Coltrane's giant steps. Faye Anderson, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Our February interview with Faye Anderson, director of All That Philly Jazz, about the perilous state of the John Coltrane House in North Philadelphia. This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup, and when we get back from the break, we'll hear from a local educator who's taken it upon herself to teach kids how to avoid conflict and stem domestic violence. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup, Memorial Day edition. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Domestic violence takes the lives of approximately 19 people every year in Philadelphia, according to the group Women Against Abuse. Many more incidents end in injury to women and men. City police, it's estimated, respond to at least 100,000 911 calls on domestic situations annually. Some of those likely involve teen relationships. By some estimates, the number of Philly students physically hurt by a boyfriend or girlfriend is nearly double the national average. And this is where a woman who calls herself Coach V is stepping in. Valencia Peterson teaches a class which attempts to break the cycle of domestic violence and sexual assault among teens and young adults. She's also head of a nonprofit called Open Door Abuse Awareness and Prevention. Valencia Peterson joined us in studio, along with student Jacquez Mabin, to talk about her work. So, you know, on a serious note, when we think of domestic violence, the picture that often comes to mind is that of a woman who is being abused by a partner. Maybe she has children. You know, it can be difficult and dangerous to escape the situation. But fair to say, domestic violence between young people in high school and college is not talked about as often, but it does exist. And Valencia, does it mirror what we see in adults?
Oh, my gosh, yes, definitely. definitely, because it starts, you know, a lot of our kids, they're dealing with learned behaviors, right? They see it at home, they think it's normal, and then they do it too. So what ODAP does, we seek to break that cycle by making them aware of the fact that they might be following in a step that's an abusive pattern. And many times our kids will say, is that abuse? We didn't know that was abuse. That's a normal action in our home.
Mm. Well, so give us an example of what you're talking about.
One of our players, we were talking together, and he went with a talk with me. I like taking my players out with me. And he decided to speak, and he mentioned how ODAP particularly helped him and his family because he had noticed his dad treating his mom a certain way. Mm-hmm. And before being in a program, he would never have understood how that wasn't right. So as he was talking freely, just freely, he ends up saying, you know, to everybody, well, I'm really proud because now I'm teaching my dad how to treat my mother. Now, I didn't expect that, right? I didn't know. But because we were asked to come and speak about our program, I just let him, kind of like what I'm doing today, I bling my players because they're the future of ODAP.
Yeah.
And I want them to see what we're doing and the impact we're having. But he surprised me by saying that. So now we're affecting generations because this young man is going back. He is talking to his dad. He's explaining, this is not what we should do, Dad. I'm learning that. And because of that, Dad is called to account. And then I meet Dad, right?
Yeah.
I meet Dad because I'm very involved in my players' lives.
Jacquez, what did you think when you first saw Coach V on the sidelines?
Oh, when I first saw Coach V on the sidelines, it was a new experience because I was like, who is this lady? I'm not exactly sure who she is and why she's here. But then, like, when I actually came to the sideline, like, during halftime, and I seen her, she told us to, like, keep our heads up and, like, stay focused on the game. So I'm like, oh, I'm thinking she's here to be a motivational speaker. But then after that, like, after the game was over, she was like, no, I'm actually here to coach you guys and, like, to be here for a new program I'm starting up called ODAP, Open Doors Abuse Awareness Prevention.
Yeah.
And I want to help you guys, and, like, I want you guys to be the foundation of this program, and I want to build up and, like, make it go, like, nationwide, worldwide, however far we can get it.
When you first start to talk to young people, and you do talk to both young men and young women,
yes,
but
yes.
In this case, of course, you're talking about a football team.
Yeah.
What do you first start to talk about? Anger? How do you begin to talk to young people? Because I know, you know, from my own children, sometimes when you're an adolescent, you don't necessarily want to talk to adults, open up to adults, because you keep things close to the vest. So how do you begin?
Basically, just by being present. How about that? Just by being present. You know, I observe them, right? Like you might have read in the article, on Wednesday mornings I go to Penwood 6:45. I have on a shirt that says free hugs. I'm just there, right? Every Wednesday. I've been doing this for years, right, Jacquez? He comes in and gets his hug every morning.
Yes.
But I'm just there. And I may compliment them. I really like your hair today. You can do it. Right? Just simple stuff, right? And then they'll see me again. It is about being present. It's not so much about what to say. They don't care how much you know. They just want to know how much you care.
But you also tackle issues head on.
Yes.
Like anger and anger management.
Yes.
Where do you go with that? And what are some of the stresses in a young person's life that might lead to anger against somebody else in a relationship? And I'm going to ask you the same thing too, Jacquez, but let's let Valencia answer first.
Well, first of all, I have to give a shout out to Lakeside Global Institute. They've done so much in trauma, and I've been a part of their organization and learning from them. But the first thing I really try to do is make them aware, right? I have a program or exercise I do where I get them to start to think about, where is your anger starting from? Where does it start? And I had them put a dot on that area of their body. And they, first of all, it made them stop and think about, where does my anger come from, right? That's the first thing. Once they realize where their anger comes from, now we can start to help regulate. Because you know, right before you're going to hit somebody, your fist will ball up, right? You have a reaction in your body. So by making them aware of that original reaction, they can go, okay, my fists are starting to ball up. I'm starting to get angry. Or my face or my cheek is tightening up, I'm starting to get angry, right? So the idea is bringing awareness to their own bodies, their own sensations, so that they can start to take a different course, if you will. Okay, I need to remove myself. I'm getting worked up, right? And this is a way to get them regulated. So this is one of the things I definitely do with my my students I work with, bringing awareness to how they feel.
Jacquez, what was your reaction when Coach V first started talking about anger? Anybody was an angry person on the team, or as a young person experiencing anger, and how you might deal with that?
Okay. My reaction on how she brought up anger was, I was going to say, like, what exactly the sticker situation she brought up. I was going to say, like, I put one on my head because, like, I think a lot. So I think
that's where the anger might be, so yeah. The physical manifestation of it. Okay.
So I think a lot before I react. And then I put one on my heart because my heart, like, it starts racing. And it's like, I just got that feeling. And I don't want to do nothing. It's like something that's boiling up inside me. And, like, I don't know what to do. And then I put one on my hand because I get angry, like, fast. But I don't want to, like, hit nothing or react out of consciousness.
Yeah. So you found that helpful?
Yes, I did.
So let's talk about relationships, as opposed to maybe somebody you might get angry with, a teammate or somebody else, you know, who you might know in your neighborhood. How is it difficult to navigate? It's been a long time since I've been. I guess you're probably about 17, 18 years old. It's been a long time since I've been there. You know, what's it like navigating relationships at your age, Jacquez?
Okay, so navigating relationships at my age, it's a different time in high school. I mean, like, it's a lot going on. So, like, I have a girlfriend, okay? She travels back and forth to New York and Philadelphia a lot because she's from there. So it's like I try and like make time with her because I also play baseball and I play football. So it's like I'm trying to make time with her and make time for my activities and school at the same time. So it's like it's stressful, but like, you know, you have to do it. So I guess I'm preferring like as an adult, like how you have like if you work two jobs and like you got kids, it's like trying to find time to make for your kids. Like you gotta make it work. You gotta make it stretch. So, like,
that should tell you how serious it is they take these relationships.
Yeah. But if there's a lot on your plate, that can be stressful.
Yeah.
And I think when you're teaching young people about, I think there was a quote I pulled from an article, normalized behavior that shouldn't be considered to be normal.
Exactly.
Tell us about what some of that is and how you coach young people to kind of, you know, reject what this normalized behavior and how to employ healthier techniques in maintaining a good relationship.
Right. So it's a lot about bringing awareness. Okay. It's a lot about educating our kids. They can, you know, they're there. They understand. I think we need to give them more credit about comprehending these things. I think we shield them too much. That's a whole nother story. I won't go there. I could go off so many places.
You can talk
speak
openly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I could go on and on. You know, I did a workshop and I think some parents said, well, sixth grade is too early to start talking about these things, and I differ. I beg to differ because it's so true. They're ready already.
When you talk about some things, Valencia, what are you talking about?
Like how we respond to, again, it's a lot about how we respond to what we're being exposed to. Again, toxic. You're in a family. The culture of that family is screaming and hollering at each other, right? This is what they know. But then you come to Miss Coach V and I'm talking about verbal abuse and I'm giving a description of exactly what's going on in your home every day. And they're looking at me like that's abuse. And I'm saying, yes, it is.
So how do you counsel them? How do you coach them?
I coach them by giving them the tools that they need. You know, I explain to them the right way to speak to someone. Right. I explain to them exactly what is the right way to be in a relationship. Right. What it looks like to be in a healthy relationship, what you should do in particular circumstances, because I get, you know, a lot of questions. My girlfriend is this and that. How do I respond? And so I'm walking them through literally every situation and they differ. So there's been so many. I can't pull one out like boom, you know, yeah. But there's been so many of like, for instance, a young man from Del Valle hit me up and he was going through something with his girlfriend. Had a bad situation with his family and his dad and didn't want to repeat this with his girlfriend. My first reaction to him was, first of all, think about where this really is coming from. Does this have anything to do with what's gone on with you in your life? And he was able to connect the dots, right? I've told young men, start journaling your feelings. Look at where you're coming from and seeing if there's a connection to where you're going now, right? And I think that's the big awareness here. I don't think our kids really get how they're where they are right now are going to affect them where they are now, you know?
Coach V asks young men, teams, classes to take the pledge. What is the pledge?
Okay, so the pledge is you vow to respect women, respect yourself, and learn how to be it's etiquette in it, and learn how to be a man.
So what that means is, because, you know, that's a lot. Oh, my gosh, this is so short to hear so much of what we do. But it means helping each other to respect women, too, by respecting yourself first. I mean, I have young men that have been not just a bystander and not saying anything. They're calling each other to account. This pledge is a lot of them making a commitment to be respectable themselves and make sure that the guys around them are doing the exact same thing.
That can be hard to do, Jacquez. If you know, I mean, there's peer pressure, and so how do you step out of that when you see somebody doing something that you've learned through Coach V might not be healthy? You know, what do you say to a friend?
If I feel like it's too toxic, like I will go up to the person, I will approach them and be like, "Hey, this is not what you're supposed to be doing. Like, you have to treat her this way or treat this person that way. You can't just be like sitting here grabbing around by the neck, flinging around the hallway. I understand that's like your girlfriend or your loved one or whoever it is, but that's not the right way to do that. Like, you do that not even on your old time. You're not supposed to do it at all. But if you feel like you're gonna put your hands on that person, like, don't just walk away or just tell them how you truly feel and be like, okay, I need some space. I need some space to cool down. I don't want to be around you right now. Stuff like that. You got to communicate. Communication is key. If you don't have communication, you don't have nothing.
And sometimes in a toxic situation, it can escalate. So also, I'm assuming, Valencia, that you're going to say, you know, have some adults perhaps that you can turn to perhaps also bring into the situation.
Definitely.
Does that work, Jacquez?
One of my young men recently was in the hallway, and I think a girl kind of went at him real hard. Mm-hmm. And I got calls from some of the administration and his mother to say that they were impressed about his response, because all he did was grab her hands, right? And he said, look, stop, right? Just stop. Stop doing this, right? Because one of the things we do a lot is try to teach our young men how to handle these toxic situations, right? The walking away, to realizing of your anger. You notice that you got this small window before you react. What do you do? Because you've had a sticker, you've seen that you got to make a decision to walk away. But what I was proud about was his mother called me and said, Coach V, I just want to tell you that my son did the right thing, and the thing that he said was on his mind was that he knew that he's part of ODAP and he could not hit this girl.
Now, we've been talking about young men. We could use a whole, probably another hour to talk about this. Young women, so how does the program change a little bit when you're talking about young women?
As a matter of fact, we're on the cusp of doing that right now. In the school that I'm working at, I've been working with my young men since 2014, and now the girls are saying, what about us? What about us? What about us? So as of today, exactly, I'm introducing a program to the teachers at Penwood called I See You, and it's all for young women. And all it's going to be is an opportunity to sit down and hear where they're coming from, because apparently there's a reason why they're doing what they're doing, right? This is the same thing that goes for my guys, for them too. Somewhere along the line, they're hurting. They're experiencing something that's making them do what they do. So what my motto is, while there's never, ever, ever an excuse for abuse, there's always a reason why people do what they do. And the point is to get to that. So with ICU, this program we're starting now, we're hoping to get the girls to start getting in a safe space where we can start breaking down and tackling some of the stuff that's going on with them right now.
Jacquez, do you see taking any of this info once you graduate, moving on to whichever is the next step, you know, college, you know, with you and in an entirely different environment where you don't know the young people?
Yes, I actually will. I will take this with me. I will keep this forever and forever. Like, I'll wear the shirt with pride, the ODAP Integrity shirt. And I will, if anybody asks me what it means, I'll tell them what it means to be a part of ODAP, especially like in a college, like where they won't know, and like where a lot of this actually happened, where drugs and like sexual stuff, like a lot of this happens. I'll like tell them to reach out to Ms. V. I'll take them if I even have to, and like, yeah, I'll help them out a lot.
That was our January conversation with teacher Valencia Peterson about her efforts to reduce domestic violence by teaching conflict avoidance. She was joined by one of her students, Jaquez Mabin. And that does it for the Radio Times Regional Roundup Memorial Day edition. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Kelsey Hansen, and John Ahrens, who edited this show. Our thanks as well to engineer Adam Staniszewski. Mary Cummings Jordan, great to have you with us for Radio Times.